Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sutta Goswami said, although Krishna, who was examining Arjuna in religion, encouraged Arjuna to kill the son of Dronacharya, Arjuna, a great soul, did not like the idea of killing him. Although Aswatthama was a heinous murderer of Arjuna's family members. So here's the purport, Srila Prabhupada. Arjuna was a great soul, undoubtedly, which is proven here also. He is encouraged herein personally by the Lord to kill the son of Drona. But Arjuna considers the son of his great teacher should be spared, that the son of his great teacher should be spared, for he happens to be the son of Dronacharya. Even though he is an unworthy son, having done all sorts of heinous acts whimsically for no one's benefit, Lord Sri Krishna encouraged Arjuna outwardly just to test Arjuna's sense of duty. It is not that Arjuna was incomplete in his sense of his duty, nor was Lord Krishna unaware of Arjuna's sense of duty, but Lord Sri Krishna put to the test many of his pure devotees just to magnify the sense of duty. The gopis were also put to test as well. Prahlad Maharaj was also put to such a test. All pure devotees come out successful in their respective tests by the Lord. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Janajana Salakaya Chaksus Militanyena Tadamai Sri Gurave Namaha Jaitam Sarito Pangor Amamanda Matirgati Mat Sarvasa Patambojo Radha Madana Mohano. So, if we could take a moment to think about Arjuna's situation here, get a feel for that. I always like to get the context again, because sometimes we don't get that brought out exactly. He's the battle of Kurukshetra, of which the Bhagavad Gita was spoken specifically to Arjuna about duty. So I mean, this here it is. How much later is this taking place after the battle of Kurukshetra that lasted 18 days, and I'm sure Arjuna hasn't fully recovered from all the wounds, the fatigue, the battleground is just covered with all the different personalities, all his relatives that he thought was going to die, they're all dead. His teacher's dead. All these killing, you can't even imagine how many people were soldiers, and then of course their wives and their children and their fathers, all the different personalities that have just died, and it's shortly thereafter. It's not much time, maybe a week, 2 weeks, I don't know, but it's not long afterwards. Bhishma still hasn't left his body, that's two chapters. So he's being tested again for his duty. And the Bhagavad Gita, I was going to mention that. Maybe I'll go get that paper over here. That if we can remember that he's, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna started right in the second chapter, say, considering your specific duty as a kshatriya, you should know there's no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles. Therefore, no need for hesitation. So he goes through another verse right after that, like 6-7 verses in a row. O Partha, happy are those kshatriyas to whom fighting opportunities come unsought, opening the doors to the heavenly planets. If, however, you do not perform your religious duty of fighting, then you'll certainly incur sins. You'll become sinful if you don't do your duty, for neglecting your duties, and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. People will speak of your infamy, will always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. So it goes on like that. And then, of course, we understood that specifically in the Veda culture, duty is very heavily focused on, because of course the Veda culture was based on knowledge, and knowledge was what is matter and what is spirit. Those two were always concentrated on as the basic of knowledge, understanding what is matter, what is spirit, the controller of both. And we understood that in the material world, one is in the bodily conception of life, born like that into ignorance. And the senses are always whimsically wanting to gratify their desires and the mode of passion. And that's bad. That'll take you into lower, degraded forms of life. So what is there to do? What do you do? So, of course, do, car. What am I going to do? What is this? So then you become a bit intelligent that in the Veda culture, specifically, everybody had their duty to do. Otherwise, if they weren't doing their duty, if it wasn't a Vedic injunction, then they knew that they could be in a very risky territory. You could degrade yourself. You could get a different, go down into lower species of life. So there was some fear involved. So that was taken care of, that you knew if I did my duty, I wouldn't become sinful and I wouldn't become degraded. So here, Arjuna, he's being questioned again. And when I think about this, I think about it one time, it came to me today, that sometimes a lawyer will be promoted to become a judge. A lot of judges were lawyers first. Now, they're both, in one sense, had the same training. The judge, he was a lawyer. But there's something different between a judge and a lawyer. There's a finer discrimination that's required from experience, that he actually matured to understand the spirit of the law, not just the letter of the law, but he could understand, and he's recognized for that they're going to have the lawyers present their cases to the judge, and the judge with his finer discrimination is going to give the verdict. So here, Arjuna, he's being questioned about Dharma. So when you think of Dharma, if we back it up to the way that Prabhupada has originally given us this understanding, he gives us this understanding of Dharma to contrast it against religion. He says, actually there's many places he talks about Dharma, and he compares it to sugar. He says the taste of sugar is sweet. That is the dharma of sugar. It's a quality that cannot be taken from sugar. If sugar is not sweet, it's not sugar. If fire's not hot, it's not fire. So Prabhupada says, so what is the dharma of the living entity? Well, when he's in the bodily conception of life, then you had the varnashram dharma. But here, he's also mentioning, Prabhupada mentions in the purport that the gopis, they were put to such a test. So I did find where that was. I looked these things up, Prahlad, what his test was and what the gopis' test were. Let me see. It's there it is. So I found it in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on this particular verse that we're on, and I can read some of that. So his commentary was, though incited by Krishna, who was testing Arjuna's sense of justice, Arjuna did not want to kill him, even though he had killed his sons, because he was intelligent. He knew the nature of Krishna. Krishna's nature is that though he is omniscient, he tests the devotees in this way in order to show their sense of justice to others. He tests Arjuna, possessor of Dharma, by showing Vrata and Rudra rasas when he says, you should not release him. This, off from the commentary again, back onto me for a second, when I was thinking about how Krishna does one thing externally, it said, how did it say here, that he was, outwardly. He says, outwardly, he was just to test Arjuna. So this type of confidential understanding is what makes a test. He didn't give it away. Here's Krishna. Generally, someone would say, Krishna tells me directly to kill someone, I should kill him. But we find, even in the Nuremberg trials, they said, no, you're always supposed to maintain a certain understanding of your own. When you go along, even if it's a direct order, you're not always, it's not always the best thing to do. So here, Krishna outwardly is saying that, but inwardly, he has this other point. And I was noticing today that Krishna is not all about it has to happen a particular way. He's flexible. So when Arjuna presents his argument, when Draupadi presents his argument, Krishna accepts it, and he's pleased. So we see that all through the pastimes that Krishna's not just, here's what I say, you do it. He's interested, just like with witness Gopi, the deity who told that I cannot walk, and the Brahmin that was there says, if you can talk, you can walk. So he came. He likes that. Krishna, just like this fighting spirit. Krishna has this fighting spirit. Later on this week, I'll be going into Gainesville, and we're talking about Grandfather Bhishma, who's fighting with Krishna, and Krishna was enjoying that. He was shooting arrows at Krishna, and Krishna was enjoying it. So he's full Akila Rasmarita Murti. He's complete in all 12 rasas. He's the form of all the different rasas. And that's where Krishna wants to exchange with the devotees, not just the formalities, but really to the specific where are you at? And he interacts with you. It's not always you're supposed to be somebody else. It's who are you? What are you feeling? What are your reasons behind what you're doing? And that's so important for a devotee to become grounded in his own identity, that we are someplace. We are someplace right now. We understand something right now. And from there, we have to speak. So I'll go on a little bit more. The next paragraph here was, in the same way, Krishna tested the gopis, the possessors of prema, by showing that karma and gyan in such verses, such as para dharmam, the highest religious duty for a woman is to sincerely serve her husband. And he quotes the Sanskrit for that. You are never actually, and then he tells him, you are never actually separated from me. I'm the soul of all creators, of all the creation. Aham hi sarva bhutanam adir anto antar prabhir. Dear ladies, I am the beginning and the end of all created beings that exist both within and without. So with the gopis, of course, we understand, even though Krishna, when he was explaining to Arjuna all the facets of Dharma, what was his last instruction to Krishna? Sarva dharmam pratyaja. Give up all your dharma and just surrender. So Krishna doesn't make things so black and white. He wants you to understand with your heart and respond back. It's what's it called? The mysteries of my understanding. So he also, next paragraph he says, he also tested Prahlad and others, that were filled with devotion by showing or promising, by showing or promising enjoyment and powers to them. Dear Prithu, you may therefore ask from me any benediction you like. This was, Maharaj Prithu, 4/20/16. It is my pastime to fulfill the desires of all living entities, and therefore you may ask me any benediction you desire. I think he also said that to Prahlad, to ask him for some benediction. Prahlad says, I'm all right. He says, accept the sufferings of all the living entities. And that's just what Lord Nisringadeva wanted to hear. You know, that is so nice to always think of others. And we see that that's the clue, that's this thread that runs through all of these pastimes with the devotees being tested. Just like we can think of that one where Yudhisthira was being tested on Dharma by his father, Yamaraj, in the form of a yaksha in the lake of death. And he was so pleased with Yudhisthira's fine answers and his respect that he says, you can bring one of your brothers back to life. They were all the Pandavas, the other four were all dead. And Yudhisthira is seeing all four of them dead, so Yamaraj says, you can bring one of them back to life. And his answer was that, I think it was Sahadev. And he says, why Sahadev? I mean, you need Bhima, you need Arjun. Why Sahadev? And he says, well, Madri had two sons, and we already have, if I'm alive, then Kunti, she has one son that's alive, but Madri wouldn't have any, so I want to honor her. So that was so exalted of an answer that he brought all of them back to life. So in these stories, these pastimes, they're stories in one sense because for Kali Yuga, it's easier for us to remember, but they're actually all the Vedic principles are in each one of these and they're all factual. So so he understood, just like as this story unfolds, that it was the mother's the consideration, that Asvatthama's mother was one that actually was the consideration, that she's the one who will actually suffer by killing Asvatthama. So even though Asvatthama, he deserved to die, the real person that would suffer would be the mother, and why should she suffer? Why should so ultimately that's going to be some further classes. But at this particular point, we're just seeing how he's examining, so we could think about a little bit that in our life also, it's not always black and white. That even though there's a good answer, like sometimes if you're given a the go-ahead to go do something, especially in the West, so many times people tell you to go do something, but it goes against your heart. It doesn't seem right, even though it's authorized to do. You still don't want to do it. So here, in this situation, here's Krishna telling him, "Go. He deserves to be killed. You should kill him." And here's Krishna telling him, so how could he do anything wrong by just listening to Krishna right there as his friend telling him what to do? But he wasn't. He was doing it. So this is very important for us to understand also, of that subtle feeling inside that you learn to trust that this doesn't feel right to me, even though it appears to be authorized because there's many things that take place like that. And one has to have his strength to be able to say with conviction what it is that he's feeling and why he feels like that. Because devotees we all have to be in touch like that. to understand. So those are a couple of my points that I wanted to make. It's the reciprocation between Krishna. He could have just went along with it, but that's not how it works. What's he looking for in you? So what I wanted to do is, according to who do you think you, who's your identity with? How do you identify yourself when you're making these decisions? So of course, dharma generally refers to the varnas and the ashrams, doing your duty according to the body that you have. But I was thinking of this today, because of Sanatana Goswami's appearance day. When Sanatana Goswami, he met Lord Chaitanya, and he says, "I was born in a low family. My associates are all low-class men. I myself am fallen and of the lowest of men. Indeed, I passed my whole life fallen in the well of sinful materialism. I do not know what is beneficial for me and what is detrimental. Nevertheless, in ordinary dealings, people consider me a learned scholar. I am also thinking of myself as such. Out of your causeless mercy, you have delivered me from materialistic path. Now, by that same causeless mercy, tell me what my dharma is. Tell me what my duty is." So here, this is Sanatana Goswami. He's asking that question. And then the next verse, that's the famous verse. Nahari, I don't know, it may be hard for you to unmute. I don't know what Ramananda has, how he's got these things set up. So anyway, the next verse was that Kayami Kena Amaya Jara Tapa Troy, where it says, "Who am I? Why do the threefold miseries always give me trouble? If I do not know this, how can I be benefited?" Oh, there you are. Want to say it, Denari?
Hang on, Madonna. Let me see if I'm unmuted here.
You're unmuted. I can hear you.
Okay. All right. That was Ke Ame Kene Ame Jari Tapa Troy Iha Nahi Jani Kamene Hitahoi. Ke Ame, who am I? Ke Ame, can I, why am I, I guess, unto me, Jare Tapa Troy? Why am I suffering the threefold miseries in this world? And he says, Iha Nahi Jani, if I cannot know this, Kamene Hitahoi, Kamene how? Kamene Hitahoi, how can I be benefited?
So here's the same point. And as we were singing those songs to the departed Vaishnavas, if you think about it, unless they have come, there's no way for us to get this information. No university, no books. There isn't anybody in the whole material world that can give this information to us. So that's why he's saying, out of your causeless mercy, you're doing this. Actually, I do not know how to inquire about the goal of life and the process of obtaining it. Being merciful upon me, please explain all these truths. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "Lord Krishna has bestowed his full mercy upon you so that all these things are known to you. For you, the threefold miseries certainly do not exist. Since you possess Lord Krishna's mercy, you certainly know these things. However," this is the point that ties a lot of this together for us, the testing part. "However, it is the nature of a sadhu to inquire. Although he knows these things, the sadhu inquires for the sake of strictness, and it's for the benefit of others. Those who are anxious to awaken their spiritual consciousness, who have unflinching intelligence, and who are not deviated, certainly obtain the desired goal. If you are fit to propagate this cult of devotional service, therefore gradually hear all these truths about it from me, and I shall tell you." So, just like we were talking about in Dharma, there you have to know what your identity is. The Dharma was said for the living entity is eternal and he serves. That's just like the sugar. The sweetness cannot be taken from sugar, so the Dharma for the living entity, actually Prabhupada says quite a few ways. I looked that up, and for the first like 15 hits or 10 hits, there's quite a few, like 40. I just put in sugar and Dharma, and you come right in the middle of where Prabhupada's talking about how religion is different than Dharma. Religion can change, but Dharma can never change, and he gives so many different examples of that. And the first ones, he was saying, your nature is to love. You're eternal, you're conscious, and your nature is to love. But we repose our love in something that's temporary, and that's not that's incorrect. Our Dharma is to love Krishna. So when you know what your identity is, then you understand what your Dharma is. You're always going to serve, but in the conditioned life, you serve the modes of nature. You serve the senses. The serving can't be stopped. It's just misdirected. So self-realization, the Sanatan Dharma, is to serve Krishna directly, favorably, free from jnana and fruitive intentions. So he continues on, and in a couple, these are, you're going to run across some of these the verses that we all know. In fact, I think it's what 108, 117 of this chapter. So I'll read a couple more. It is the living entity's constitutional position to be eternal servant of Krishna. Because he is in the marginal energy of Krishna and a manifestation simultaneously one and different from the Lord, like a molecule, particle of sunshine or fire, Krishna has three varieties of energy. Nahar, you're unmuted.
Okay. I'll fix it. I'm sorry. I got it.
Yeah, you have it. Just as fire, just as the illumination of fire, which is situated in one place, is spread all over, the energies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Param Brahman, is spread all over the universe. Lord Krishna has three energetic transformations, and these are known as the spiritual potency, the living entity, and the illusory potency. I'm just going to read a couple more. Originally, Krishna's energy is spiritual, and energy known as the living entity is also spiritual. However, there is another energy called illusion, which consists of fruitive activities, and this is the Lord's third potency. All the creative energies, which are inconceivable to a common man, exist in the Supreme Absolute Truth. These inconceivable energies act in the process of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. O chief among aesthetics, he's talking to Sanatan Goswami, as there are two energies possessed of fire, namely heat and light, there are inconceivable creative energies that are natural characteristics of the Absolute Truth. And then, let's see, I'm going to... O king, the Kshetragya Shakti is the living entity. Although he has facility to live in either the material or spiritual world, he suffers the threefold miseries of material existence because he's influenced by the avidya, nescience, potency, which covers his constitutional position. The living entity, covered by the influence of nescience, exists in different forms in the material condition. O king, he is thus proportionately freed from the influence of material energy to a greater or lesser degrees. Two more verses here. Besides this inferior energy, inferior nature, O mighty armed Arjuna, there is a superior energy of mine which consists of all living entities who are struggling with the material nature and are sustaining the universe. So we know that was Bhagavad Gita 7.5. So, let's see, okay. So this, we're going to, Lord Chaitanya talking to Sanatana Goswami is answering his question, who he is. And in order for you to perform your dharma, because I think about it sometimes that these mantras, they need to have consciousness for them to work. And we had this wonderful festival here yesterday, Chandan Festival. All the deities were covered in Chandan, and all the outfits that they wore and everything, the bracelets, the necklaces, crowns, everything was made of flowers. It was most incredible. It took enormous effort to do it. It was a gorgeous festival. So this devotion, Bhava Grahi Janardhan, that Krishna, he's looking not how accurate everything is, but he's looking for the devotion in it. And that's what we're growing in our consciousness, this path of bhakti, is you have to put the consciousness of devotion when you're chanting before the deities, when you're chanting your japa, when you're doing sankirtan, when you're cooking, whatever process you're doing, this devotion has to be maximized and increased all the time. Everything that we're hearing has to be applied to increase the quality of devotion. That's what Krishna's looking at. So he's saying that if you don't serve that devotion, you'll be serving the external energy and you'll become covered. And because it's a subtle thing, that bodily identification is very ingrained in us. When you look in the mirror, you sign your name, fill out a form, you're always being reconnected with this idea of being the body and the bodily conception of life. The senses and the sense objects are always pushing on this point, the false ego. So this devotion is the only thing that breaks that chain. Ropes, karma, with how to do it for devotion, for Krishna. And Kevalananda Khan Prabhupada's made it, Lord Chaitanya's teachings, how to make it just a joyful process, but you have to add the consciousness. We can't stay, there's a lot of ajñāta sukriti, but as we understand more and more, the consciousness, just like I was talking to a devotee about inattention in japa or in chanting Hare Krishna, and he pointed out that it's according, one definition of the inattentiveness is according to the modes of nature. Like inattention in the mode of ignorance is you're too tired to actually have the strength to focus the qualities of your consciousness on hearing and chanting with devotion. So you're just kind of like, you're doing it, but there's not much participation. It's just doing it or you're falling asleep while you're doing it. In a mode of passion, you're distracted by unlimited things that you have to do, either today, tomorrow, or sometime. There's so many different things that are coming in. But the inattention in a mode of goodness was quite extraordinary. It has to do with the quality of your intimacy in accepting Krishna. As he's not different from his name. He's actually there. And you're with Krishna when you're chanting. And there's like sometimes like a, I would say like a piece of glass. You may be able to see it, but you can't touch it. It's on the other side of some wall, even though it may be transparent. The idea of accepting the feeling of, and giving your heart when you're chanting. So in the mode of goodness, you can do everything mechanically correct. You can hear, you can chant, you can pronounce each syllable, you can use your upper and lower lip, you can use your tongue. You can do everything just right. You know, you're wide awake, you're keeping your mind from running into so many other things. But still, there's an element of giving your heart that changes as the inattentiveness in the mode of goodness. Try to see it more as a quality of intimacy, that you're not really allowing that Krishna, the intimacy with Krishna to manifest because of this type of inattention. It's something like, in a gross example, like cold shoulder. The person's there, you're talking, but you're really not feeling the exchange. There's something subtle there. So I just found that a fascinating thing to focus on, inattention in the mode of goodness. So back to the, I was going to read three more verses, and then I'm going to stop. Forgetting Krishna, the living entity has been attracted by the external feature since time immemorial. Therefore, the illusory energy Maya gives him all sorts of miseries in material existence. In the material condition, the living entity is sometimes raised to a higher planetary systems, a material prosperity, sometimes drowned in a hellish situation. His state is exactly like a criminal whom a king punishes by submerging in water and raising him again out of the water. Maybe I lost where I was going. I thought it was 117. But anyway, the famous verse is Jivera Surupoi Krishna Nityadas. That was, I thought I had it marked, but I didn't see it. That's our real identity, that we're eternal servants of Krishna, and that's spoken of to Lord Chaitanya, by Lord Chaitanya to Sanatana Goswami. So, and then of course he tells them about the treasure, this great treasure to find this Vishvam Purna Sukhayate, that the whole world becomes a place of happiness when one is actually a devotee. That's a whole nother verse. So I'll stop here then if for some comments and questions. Thank you.
Give me 1 second, Prabhu, to
everybody. 2 seconds.
Okay, I've unmuted everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, Prabhu, if anyone has a question or comment, we're ready.
Madan, you were talking about, let me get to a quieter spot. You were talking about inattentive chanting, or just really any service, it's inattentive, or our mind is really not focused on Krishna. I've had a situation, actually more than once, where it's evening, it's time to go to bed, and I realize, and I'm really tired, and I realize, oh my God, I forgot to chant my evening Gayatri. And I'm really tired. And I'm thinking, am I going to chant a really poor, inattentive Gayatri, or shall I wait till the next day and chant it twice in the morning rather than one at night? And I, ever since I read the book that I think you gave me on the Gayatri Mantra written by Mahanidhi Swami that says that, you know, if you miss a Gayatri, you could, it's okay to make it up. I've opted to chant the next day in the morning when I'm nice and fresh and I can, as much as possible, put my heart into an attentive Gayatri, as opposed to chanting a terrible one at night that I'm just mechanically, almost begrudgingly doing it to get through it. What do you think of that? You think I was good, not good? What are your thoughts?
Gee, you must be the only person that's ever had that problem. I was always hoping that I would have three mornings. Mornings are so nice. Afternoons are, that the noon one is also a little hard to get into because you can't stop. It's like trying to stop a train to sit down for a couple minutes to chant your Gayatri. And in the evening, that's a fact. But I'm not really qualified to say, maybe somebody else would, because factually it seems like I should just chant all three in the morning, because the other ones are, I always hope that I could have three mornings, these afternoons and evenings. It's so nice, the morning time. But maybe we can see if any devotees have something they could say on that. There's so many wonderful devotees on this Sangha here.
No one's going to say anything. I agree that the noon one for me is the toughest. It's like stopping a train because the mode of passion is so strong. It's really hard sometimes to stop. You really have to be disciplined. Back when I got my iPhone a couple of years ago, I programmed in a bell to go off at noon and to And it does a pretty good job of stopping me. Definitely not 100%. But
that's the toughest.
But I found that, just for me, I found in the late afternoon, right around sunset, there's like a really mellow, sweet time, and that's like the sweet spot for the evening Gayatri. And if I can chant my Gayatri when it's, you know, the sun's starting to set and there's really nice colors in the sky, it just seems like there's this little sweet window. And often I'll chant an extra round or two during that time, but definitely the Gayatri. And if I can get it in that little sweet window, then it's not as good as the morning, but it seems pretty good. But boy, if after that, when the mode of ignorance seems to start pulling in to want me to go to sleep, it's tough.
Haribo.
Jai, Pushkarji, go ahead.
You have to consider now, Kirtananda told me this back in 71, that he was in L.A. one time with Prabhupada, and it was pretty late. It was like 10 o'clock at night, and he started, probably you don't know, Kirtananda used to chant Gayatri real quick. I mean, in fact, that's a whole other topic, but whether he chanted the whole Gayatri or whatever he chanted, but so he started chanting. Prabhupada said, what are you doing? He said, I'm chanting Gayatri. And Prabhupada said, no, it is too late now. Because it was 10 o'clock, you know. And, of course, Prabhupada never said, do it tomorrow. But what he also said, and I remember this because my memory is still pretty good, he said, at least make sure you do the morning one. Now, you could say, well, that's Kirtananda, that's 1970, it happened, or whatever. Kirtananda wasn't in L.A. that much, but he was there a couple times. And anyway, he told me that on the side, but that... It's not like an absolute thing. It's just an anecdote. So he pulls out. He's chanting. It's late at night. Prabhupada says, it is too late now. And then he said something about, make sure you do the morning one. So apparently morning one is always considered the most important one, according to that anecdote. But,
I can tell you another anecdote. I was with one devotee. Adarshi was his name. I don't know if any of you know him. But he said that one time Srila Prabhupada with some devotees, and by the time the devotees pulled out their thread, Prabhupada was done chanting his Gayatri. He chanted it that fast. Anyone ever heard that?
Say it again. But it's like saying, like they were drawing guns, six guns in the West or something. Like by the time they reached for their threads, Prabhupada was finished.
Yeah, you know, but
what does that mean, really? I mean, does that mean like they all pulled out the threads at the same time, but by the time Prabhupada chanted it so quick that they were just like still on grabbing their threads? I mean, that sounds funny, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I heard
the
same.
Did it in less than a minute.
Were you adding the exaggeration of by the time they pulled out their thread, or?
I don't know. That's a story that I heard this devotee told me.
That's like a guy's when they reach for the holster, but the guy's so fast on the quick on the draw that he shoots everybody. But, there's so many stories that Bhakti Siddhanta chanted 16 rounds in 12 in an hour. Cause especially when he was chanting 190 rounds a day, you get probably pretty quick because it already is going to take a long time. Even if 16 rounds was done in an hour, you're still looking at three times for 12 hours.
When I took Brahmin initiation, our GBC was Satsarup Maharaj, and I was pretty good friends with him. I mean, as much as you can be friends with such an exalted devotee. But I noticed when he chanted his Gayatri that he always moved his lips. Because it was chanted silently, but still he would move his lips to make sure he was pronouncing in his mind every word. And I sort of always followed that.
Nobody said you weren't supposed to move your lips. Nobody ever said you weren't supposed to move your lips. You're supposed to murmur it to yourself. I mean, you're supposed to hear it yourself, and others aren't supposed to. But
I was saying that positively. By moving the lips, you're forcing yourself to say every word and every syllable.
Yeah. Right. You're supposed to murmur it. Murmurs. Murmurs. Murmuring. But I never read where you silently have to chant. Of course, if you're in the middle of a huge whatever.
Oh, that's not. I didn't know that. I thought that it's silent, but that's nice that it's murmured, because I guess that's sort of what I do.
There's one lecture where Prabhupada's talking about chanting japa, and he says, not silent! I don't remember, I don't even know what lecture it is, but he very emphatically, and he just suddenly yells, not silent! And I immediately thought of how Kirtananda did do silent chanting, you know, in New Vrindavan at one point, silent. Everybody had to be silent, you know, wear those funny robes. And
Hari Bol, I wanted to add something about Guru Purnima. I looked it up while we were talking. It's celebrated on the full moon day in the month of Ashad, according to the Hindu calendar, which corresponds to the month of July. Since great importance is given to the relation of a guru and disciple in the Indian culture, on this day, the disciple expresses his gratitude to the guru.
Yeah, well, Prabhupada never stressed it because he introduced Vyasa Puja, which is more or less the same thing, but specifically for the. And plus, we don't follow Hindu Indian culture that closely. We follow Vaishnav culture, but yeah, people do Guru Purnima, whatever.
I'll ask Madan or Pushkar. Where did all these? I mean, back in the 70s, especially when Prabhupada was with us, there's a certain number of days that we honored and celebrated, but now there's like a whole lot more. Like the Vaishnav calendar is full of all kinds of new things. Who decided? Where do they all come from?
They're not new. They've been there for hundreds of
years. I understand, but within ISKCON, they were never, so many were just never celebrated, or who decided which ones are important, which ones aren't important? Where did this all come from?
I don't think we've added that many, frankly. I mean, we had like the major gurus like Gorgashur, Bhaktivinoda, Bhakti Siddhanta, that we did half-day fast, and we had the Vishnu, you know, Ramchandra Nrisimha, like that, Vamana and Varaha. None of that's changed. Krishna, Balaram, Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya. The only increase that we see on the calendar, like today, Sanatana Goswami, we didn't have all the information, and probably didn't have time. He didn't want to clutter up our tiny minds with all the stuff, but gradually, I think you could see it like the Archanapadati, which Prabhupada was trying to introduce before he left the planet, which was, you know, detailed, and it's taking some of the essence out of Hari Bhakti Vilas. All those things are there. There's nothing wrong with acknowledging Sanatana Goswami, obviously. We don't fast on a day, but we could sing a song on a disappearance day. Today's a disappearance day, you know. Janila Pramadana, there's nothing wrong with it, but and we know, we weren't aware, we didn't have Chaitanya Chitrabhita finished until 75, okay, but then, you know, we didn't really have familiarity with all the Goswamis and Srinivasacharya and what to speak of Rasikananda and all the others, but now we have some bio data on all these people so we can relate to them. Mm-hmm. And it's good to acknowledge them, but what would be the use of acknowledging all of them, just names, you know? And still, some of just names, they're not that much known about every single person on it, but we don't have to fast on them. We just read it, and we could acknowledge that it's there. I mean, but as far as having a whole class, probably never did that. That's a fact. He didn't have a whole class on every single, you know, person each time. But, say, that extra stuff, there's nothing wrong in knowing about it.
Good.
Sanatana Goswami. He's so important because of the Sambandha Gyan, and he's one of his temple that was built in Vrindavan is one of the main landmarks, at least, you know, the Madan Mohan temple. And there's the story that his deity talked to him, asked him about salt on his chapati. So that's quite extraordinary. And of course,
it wasn't just that. I think the deity was dug up, and there's a whole story, you know, that how the deity was being taken care of by that Brahmin, and the Brahmin gave it to Sanata, and
so
then, you know, there's more stuff too. A deity told him, "I'm staying with this Brahmin," you know, and that Brahmin wasn't really taken care of properly, and there's a lot of stuff backstory also.
That those things, that's what the ears, everything we're meant to hear. That, and there's a certain relish that devotees have for hearing that, that Krishna enjoys to see these devotees relishing. There's something very special about how devotees enjoy hearing about these things. So the more that as other things get minimized, this fills in all the rest, not artificially, just naturally.
Well, you could go the other extreme is, I could say another anecdote. I'm full of anecdotes, but when I was in Europe back in the early 80s, especially, we had Prabhupada's disappearance day, or appearance, I think it might have been one of them. Probably disappearance. And I was shocked when I saw some newer generation devotees. They were just hobnobbing around as though there were no you know, it was no special day or anything, and they were eating, it was a fast day. And I said, hey, you know, it's Prabhupada's disappearance. They said, well, Prabhupada's not our guru. And I was thinking, wow, we don't, you know, we're really in bad shape here. If these are the new bhaktas are thinking like that, that they don't even need to acknowledge Prabhupada. I mean, their training was really piss poor, you know.
I have a question with regard to this, the direction that this conversation is going in. This is Balabhadra, by the way. First of all, with the way that the Vaishnava calendar reads today as to what it used to read many years ago, for example, Ekadashi, this is because today being the first month of Chaturmasya, the first day of the first month of Chaturmasya, I remember that on this particular fast, it used to say fasting from spinach. Now it says from all green leafy vegetables, first of all. And second of all, it seems that amongst many devotees, even the older devotees, observing Chaturmasya is not such a strict standard anymore. What's your take on that, Prabhu's? Anyone?
Well, my theory about the spinach versus green leafy is this, and it doesn't really solve the problem, but at least it puts a little light on it. The fact that I think in India, in old days, they didn't have other green leafies except for spinach. I mean, there's 20 types of spinach, but they didn't have kale, cabbage, arugula, whatever you have. You know, like they didn't have collard greens and mustard greens. I mean, whatever we eat is greens. You know, so when it said fasting from, they probably didn't have the word spinach too. They had 20 types of spinach mentioned in Chaitanya Bhagavat, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions them because he has one of his Prasadam songs is glorifying Shak. Shak Asfadane, Heno. This Krishna certainly tasted it. You know, he comes into the house of a Dvaitacharya and he said, wow, this Shak is so good. And then he starts describing the 20 types of spinach, and even before that, people weren't aware, oh, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu loves spinach, so then everyone would make spinach, and there were 20 types that Lord Chaitanya, of course, knew all of them. So I think that's where we get the green leafy. They just, maybe somebody was just covering themselves and just saying, no, we shouldn't eat. You know, I don't really know that part, but it seems to me that's educated speculation that they didn't have other green leafies, and that so therefore Prabhupada said spinach when he came. Also, he probably didn't eat cabbage or anything else ever, you know. The only green leafy he ate was spinach. So when he said it, spinach, but it, you know, it might really refer to everything. So but that part we don't know. But I could see where that change would come about. Someone would say, well, let's just stop all green leafies because people are eating this and that. I don't really know that part, and it'd be hard to trace out. It would be, if someone doing a forensic study could go all over, you know, Gaudiya Math and study what Bhakti Siddhanta said and talk to all the senior most Vaishnavas on the planet and try to get an understanding, you know, but I won't be the person to do it, but we, you know, gradually we get an email, we could ask someone who's knowledgeable what they think. Something, if somebody really wanted to solve that conundrum, whether it's spinach or all green leafies. Because I remember in the old days we would eat cabbage and we would just didn't eat spinach during probably stuff.
And then what about the fact that it seems that even amongst all the devotees, that the thought of observing Chaturmasya strictly seems to have lost its significance. I mean, like when I joined, there was no question of anyone not observing Chaturmasya.
Yeah, well, if you live in Alachua where we live, you'll see that many people don't follow any. Like, if you go, there's huge mounts of prasadam sold on fast days, Janmashtami, Gopinim. Everyone's lined up. I mean, there's not that many people fasting even on Janmashtami, Gopinim, or any, you know. And Prabhupada wanted, like, a strict Ekadasi feast for Gopinim and Janmashtami, and people mostly don't follow that. Some places in India. So a lot of stuff, you know, gets diluted down. You know, Mangalarti, forget it. Guru Puja, forget it. Don't see a lot of people. What to speak of Charamasa? I mean, why would anyone follow that? They're not even attending any of the functions, so it doesn't, you know, doesn't really register that much. So,
what are your thoughts on Chaturmasya? I'm sorry, I had a phone call. Did you wait when you started talking about Chaturmasya? So, what was your point on Chaturmasya when I joined in the early 70s? I mean, most people didn't observe it, but maybe it's just where I was down in Miami.
They didn't.
Well, no,
did not.
No, when I joined in Denver, and that was back in 77, and I never heard of anybody not following Chaturmasya, not at the Denver Temple, at least, you know.
Actually, you're right. I'm sorry, now it's coming back. We did actually observe it, but I don't know how strictly. That's right, we didn't have spinach, then the yogurt and dal and so on. That's right. We did observe.
It's only it's very minimal.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's four things. I mean, right. Really strict observance. Srila, you know, Ekartik Bhakti Siddhanta would eat only, like, you know, he'd start off eating 15 bites, and then according to the moon, phases of the moon, he'd go down 14, 13, till on the dark moon, practically, you're eating only one bite of food off the floor, you know. That's Kartik. I'm not sure about the whole Chaturmasya, but there's strict observances.
It's all about regulation. If you don't, you know, if you don't observe anything, you know, if you don't observe, it all starts to unravel. These are token fasts, but they're meant to stop you from, you know, remind you you're supposed to be controlling your senses in favor of Krishna. You know, these are meant for just us to regulate ourselves. So, yeah, that's tragic that devotees aren't even following Janmashtami, the fast on Janmashtami. Are you serious?
You could ask Madan Mohan. Selling prasadam is huge. Huge on those days. Huge. I mean,
well, there's many varieties of devotees. The sadhakas that actually come to the Mangalarti every day, there's maybe, 50 or 30, and then there's other ones that they health issues keep them, but they still follow everything. And then, so over the time period, as far as I know, most people are chanting their 16 rounds, following the principles, and hearing to some degree. But as everything develops, especially in a large community, there's people that are attracted to be near devotees. They don't particularly follow things, but they like to come to the programs. Like, so there's the Sunday feast group, and then amongst the Sunday feast group, there's ones that, go the other way. That there's ones that only come on Janmashtami and about five holidays a year. Then there's the ones that'll come on more holidays, maybe for Kartik, and then there's ones that only come on the Sunday program. And then there's a scale. Whenever you have because the society has grown, and there's people that bring their kids to the school, they want their kids to have the good upbringing, but they're not following so strictly themselves. But they're still, so there's all different gradations, and it's natural at this particular time that way the society has grown, that not everybody, like if we go back to the 70s, how many hours a day were you out on Hari Nam? I know in Los Angeles when I joined, we used to go out every day. Then it was just on the weekend. And then, it was all day on all day Saturday. We used to get this special bread they would make in L.A. that you'd go out 8 hours, and after 4 hours on Hari Nam, you'd eat this chunk of all-in-one bread and go out for another 4 hours. And then as time goes on, I don't know, yadaya, dharmasya, you know, it's according to the inspiration that's being felt by the devotees and the leadership. It takes different forms, and it goes on like that, as it is.
A good point, Madan. I like that.
Well,
yeah, there are many, many levels, and we really need to respect and appreciate all.
And you never know what people have in their hearts, you know, because of different circumstances they're put on. I think about two things. One, Prabhupada mentioned about a lady that used, when he was living in Vrindavan in Radha Damodar Temple, used to come by every day with a jug of water for bathing the deities. And Prabhupada sometimes would open the gate to let her in. And Prabhupada said she went back to Godhead because of that service. So judging's a very slippery slope on things, and we never know. And then there's Hanuman and the spider, greatest devotee. Hanuman, he's saying to the spider, what are you doing? You got this little grain of sand, you know. And Lord Ramachandra, he says his service is the same as yours. So it's really hard, but that one about the lady in Vrindavan that Prabhupada talked about that just brought a jug of water every morning for the deities, who can understand that?
Yeah, but the thing is, Madan, I remember that lady. We're not talking about ordinary people. She slept in a little alcove when you walk into the Radha Damodar Mandir. She heard all the arti. She had a japa bag. It's not like she was staying home, watching TV, coming to the temple once a year. This is someone who's like a pure devotee in Vrindavan. Just the idea that she did this minimal service, you know, she did other things, I'm sure, but she was like almost like a beggar, but they let her stay in that little thing there. When you walk in, it's like a little area, a little lady sleeping there. She'd go out and get the Jamuna water, but I don't know if you could compare that, you know. Anyway, it's just, she...
Well, you're right. Of course you can't compare, but it's the principle is that different people have different circumstances by the way life is being dealt to them. And we never know what's in their heart. You know, that it's just the way.
Yeah, but as far as like fat, you know what I mean about the fasting, it's almost like a joke. Like, it's hard to believe, like, the temple set up and they got a huge array of food, you know.
Yeah, it seems not, like, right, they shouldn't facilitate that.
And it's
that.
The temple's, on those big days, it's the temple. They don't let anyone else set up because they want to make all the money. They know no people aren't going to fast, so they don't push it. And in fact, they go the other way to make the bucks.
But at the same time, what do they do with that? They maintain the temple. They buy things that are desperately needed to keep the doors open. Anybody who's managed a temple knows that it's almost impossible. There's never enough money to ever keep things going. It's a crisis all the time.
Yeah, they're not gonna force people to eat. But at the same time, they know a lot of people eat. I mean, all the kids eat. All the second generation eat. I mean, it's hard. You could find people fasting. You definitely can find. But
yeah,
you know, you see a lot of people
fast. I fast, so there are people that do that, and there's ones. And in the meantime, everything that they do, it supports keeping it open for everybody else. I mean, I think that probably practically everybody that's on this conference, at least half, have tried to manage a temple and know the difficulty in funding the operation.
What we're looking at here is basically. To one degree, I don't know how else to better say this, but a forgetfulness of the significance of why these opportunities are there. For example, with Ekadashi and these past days, if I remember correctly, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in one of his prayers, he says that these are the mother of devotion. And so if we look at it from that perspective, that this is an opportunity for me to take shelter of my mother, for example, that these holidays, because Ekadashi, even though it's a fast day, My understanding is it's actually a holiday, a holy day. Holiday means a holy day. That's its root. That's the epistemology of the word holiday. It was originally pronounced a holy day. And so, but we know Thakur is saying that these days, which are holy days or holidays, are considered to be the mothers of devotion. And it seems to me that we've lost that perspective somewhere, obviously, which is why there's a big lax in the standards.
How should we bring it back?
Good leadership.
Exemplary.
Prabhus, we do have to close this up.
Yeah. We'll all pray for that.
Could I just say something quickly? If anyone wants to read about Chaturmas, what Srila Prabhupada said, and what I tend to go back to, you're saying, you know, how do we bring it back? I would say we bring it back by going to the books and seeing what's there, in addition to good leadership. Anyway, if anybody wants to read in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, Chapter 4, Verse 169, the purport, Srila Prabhupada just lays it all out very simply for us what to do during Chaturmas.
What was the numbers again?
Madhya Lila, Chapter 4, and it's the purport to verse 169.
I'll read that for sure, at least. Thank you.
Well, that's good. Thank you, Maharani. Prabhus, I'm sorry that I didn't say anything, but it is getting really late.
That's the best part of it all.
Thank you, Ananda.
Sorry to interrupt, but
well, it's total fucking voices. So.
I love the lively discussion. It's great.
I do, yeah.
Great class, Manan, and thank everybody for participation.
Well, mercy. Yeah,
I love it. Yes, I don't want to quit, but I know we have to. But.
We actually even had
I could throw in one more far-out anecdote, which I mentioned before, but just for
go for it. I love them.
In 74, when I was in Calcutta, and then Bhavananda, Jai Pataka, and Chutananda all were growing beards during Chaturmasya. And I'm not sure if it was Karti, but they had the beards, and I was, like, making fun of them. They were on their way up to Vrindavan to see Prabhupada. And sure enough, when they came back, they were completely clean-shaven. And they said, you know, as soon as they came in, Prabhupada said, oh, you have become hippies? And they said, well, Prabhupada, it's Chaturmasya. We've grown beards. We're not shaving. He said, no, no beards. You can lie down on the floor, chant extra rounds, but no beard. He gave that prescription. He said, you want to improve your, you know, sadhana, then he said, sleep on the floor, chant a lot of rounds, but no beard. He didn't want beard. He was so dead against beards, you know.
Well, the verse that was on the same chapter. That's text number 70. He explains that where he asks Chandrasekhar to take Tantan Goswami, make him look like a gentleman. And in the purport, he called them Dvaravesas, or hippies. He says that he says Lord Chaitanya found it objectionable to have a beard, so devotees don't like them. Objectionable.
Yeah, but that wasn't during Chaturmasya, so someone could argue, you know.
Yeah,
Sanatana Goswami was told to shave. It wasn't Chaturmasya. Well, whatever.
That's another point. But in the meantime, you're on hair, so.
So let me just ask real quick. In ISKCON, we have our rules and regulations set down by Srila Prabhupada, even though the rest of the world may be doing something slightly different or very different. Right?
Sounds, well, I don't know about very different. Just having a beard, it's kind of different, yeah. But it's like a statement, you know, because anyone senior person knows that Prabhupada didn't like beards. So when they start growing a beard and shaving once a month, it's, you know, whatever. You can figure it out on your own. I mean, I personally got a letter from Prabhupada that said avoid beards as far as possible. I was wanting to know whether to paint a beard on what's his name? Sukracharya in a painting, and he's no beard on Sukracharya, you know. Well, although the painting was done, the letter got there late. But, you know, anyway, this only, I could say, cite 10 different things where Prabhupada is down on beards and big hair. He just doesn't, not, you know. But other gurus, they, like Bhaktisiddhanta, had a big beard during Chaturmasa, so. I mean, you know, there's so many arguments. Well, that's for the West, so we don't look like hippies, and blah, blah, blah. Well, why don't we look like hippies now with beards, you know? You think we only look like hippies during the 60s and 70s, but now if you have a beard, you don't look like a hippie? Well, anyway.
Thank you, Ramananda.
We should stop. Is that okay?
Yay! Howdy, folks.
No, it's not
okay. It doesn't bother me and Don, because we're in a different time zone. We already had our morning program. We could just blab all day and night.
That's true. Well, it's 4 o'clock here in Boise, so.
We already finished our rounds, you know. We studied 30 chapters of the Bhagavatam, you know.
Before Ramananda pulls the plug, I just want to say I very much appreciate the association with all you senior devotees. Thank you.
Yeah, I do, too. Thank you very, very much.
Hi.
Great association. I love it.
By the way, Shureshwar Prabhu, he's not giving class on Saturday. So on Saturday, Kavi Chandra Maharaj is going to give Bhagavatam class, a regular Bhagavatam.
Good boy.
Wait, Shureshwar is the only one allowed to talk about Prabhupada, though.
When you give class, we're looking forward to you talking all about Srila Prabhupada.
I'm reducing my classes to annually now, so all the neck is going to be condensed in that one class.
Can't wait.
I'm going to go into a deep cave and give that class inside the cave. Anyone who wants to hear it's going to have to go down inside the Carlsbad Caverns.
Carlsbad, Mexico.
I'll come anywhere, Prabhu, to hear the nectar from you. I'll come in the cave with you. I'll sit at your feet to hear you speak. And I love your anecdotes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And all glories to Shri Prabhupada.
Thank you, Madan. Very nice class. Hey, Paul.